Hello and welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Can all-out war involving the United States be averted in the Middle East? Also, why has the national security elite unified around candidate Kamala Harris? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Goggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we cross to Dmitry Babich. He is the deputy foreign editor at Komsomolskaya Pravda Daily. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's start out with George in Budapest. Obviously, one of the main issues confronting us all now is watching the events unfolding in the Middle East. And, you know, the question is, will there be even a greater war? And I think maybe the question really should be is, why is the United States not stopping it? I think that's really what's in play right now. Go ahead.
Peter, you're absolutely right in the way you framed the question, because we are kind of seemingly on the brink of this a catastrophic war, an immensely destructive war. And the United States just is seemingly sitting on its hands, observing this and in fact, collaborating with Israel as to which targets it should and shouldn't hit. And knowing, and as we all know, that Israel doesn't even listen to anything that the United States says. So we know that Israel will unquestionably hit back against Iran's attacks last week. We know that Israel will hit back very hard. This will not be just simply symbolic attacks, because clearly that was Iran's attacks were damaging to Israel's reputation, particularly its reputation for its missile shield defense. And then they would therefore, we also know from Iran that Iran will not sit still for a for this Israeli attack and will in turn retaliate. So we've got all the makings here of a cycle of retaliation. Iran is a major power. It's not a nuclear power, but it's a huge country. It's a 90 million population. So we're really sitting on the brink of this catastrophic war. And Israel, particularly within Netanyahu in recent days, has said, well, Israel is fighting a war on seven fronts. So that's where we are. We're fighting a war on seven fronts. And there's no prospect at all of any of this getting resolved. And given the United States relationship with Israel, the United States is more than likely to get involved in one or more of these wars.
Yeah, and if it does get involved, George, it's a war of choice. It's not out of necessity. That's what makes it even more bizarre. You know, Dima, you know, obviously the horrific damage that is being done to Lebanon and its people is front and center in the news. But the genocide in Gaza continues on unabated. And a lot of commentators, particularly in the West, not only are biased in favor of Israel, but they don't really, there's very little recognition, admission that all of this could suddenly come to a stop if there was a ceasefire in Gaza, when you think about it.
Well, we're talking one day during the anniversary of the terrible Hamas attack on the 7th of October, 2023. Of course, no one in Russia is excusing this attack. That was a terrible, terrible event, terrible crime, I would say. However, there are many questions. How could that happen? You know, why did Israel, which now can destroy every leader of Hezbollah, every leader, almost every leader in the leadership of Hamas, you know, knowing precisely where they are now, you know, which building they're going to enter. How could Israel miss hundreds of people, you know, using paraplanes, using boats, penetrating into its territory? And then the border could not be closed for 4 days. For 4 days, there was still a gap in that fence, you know, and the tragedy continued. So there are many questions to be asked to Mr. Netanyahu, but his playbook is actually from the United States. Let's move on, you know. Don't ask questions about the past. Let's move on. Let's do more of it, you know. In Gaza, the response was just the destruction of the population.
It's interesting that you mentioned it, because we are on the year After the events of October 7th, George, but Netanyahu's made somewhat of a comeback against all odds. I mean, you know, in the alternative sphere, everybody's saying he's toast, he's done, he's gone. He's not, okay? And he's got Biden around his finger. I mean, talk about a change of fortune.
Yes, it's quite remarkable. His political obituary was written a little prematurely, with everybody in the West who really don't like him very much because he's just he's just a little bit obstreperous, thinking, oh great, well we'll get some really decent guy in his place. And of course, on the fundamental issues, there's no real difference between Israeli leaders. Some are a little more likable than others. It's just Netanyahu is not a terribly likable person. But yes, I mean, his obituary was written. And then we've now seen, particularly in the aftermath of the attacks against the Hezbollah leaders with the pager attacks and the walkie-talkie attacks, and then, of course, the assassination of Nasrallah, that he's seen in Israel as the hero of the hour, the tough guy, the security guy that he has always presented himself as. And it's very hard to see that somehow he's a political demise, because ultimately every one of Israel's leaders would probably pursue exactly the same policies as Netanyahu has. None of them is a peace candidate. But probably not as effectively and as ruthlessly as Netanyahu has. So it's very unlikely that he will pay any price. And all the talk about the corruption and trials and so on, I imagine he will glide by with those things as well. So I tend to think that Netanyahu is going to be around for quite some time. I mean, he's been around already at the top of Israeli politics for something like 30 years.
You know, Tima, there's been, over the last few weeks, there's been a lot of high officials, Russian officials visiting Tehran. Russia and Iran will have some kind of security agreement, which is very odd because Russia doesn't really do that with very many countries. Russia obviously wants to avoid being drawn into this. We know that the second Iranian strike on Israel, the Russians were informed, as were the Americans, and of course the Americans informed the Israelis. I'm sure that kind of cooperation is going to continue, but just going on the lines of what George said, I mean, if Israel most likely, I think inevitably, is going to strike back, but the retaliation for the retaliation, I don't think Iran is going to signal its intentions again. They will tell the Russians. To what degree would Russia go in and defend and protect Iran if things started going sideways? Go ahead, Dima.
Well, of course, the political systems of Russia and Iran are very different. And there's just one thing that we have in common ideologically. That is the rejection of the Western narrative and the rejection of Western aggression towards both of our countries. I agree with what George has just said about Netanyahu, but the problem with Netanyahu, why he irritates the West so much, is because his very conduct, his existence, contradicts the Western narrative. Because what have we heard from the West in the last few days before and after Iran's attack? Oh, this is an unprovoked attack against Israel, We heard it before, Russia's unprovoked attack against Ukraine. These are blatant lies, Just look at your own newspapers. Who killed Nasrallah, who was obviously an ally of Iran? Who killed Ismail Haniyeh on the territory of Tehran, basically? So it's denying all these facts. And then also there's a problem.
And Dima, to be fair, I mean, Iran is not killing leaders in Israel or anywhere else in the world, even though it's called the center of global terrorism. George, George, I want to put you on the spot. If the war does expand, to whose advantage is it? To Trump's or Kamala Harris's? We can probably argue both sides.
We can argue both sides. At the moment, I tend to think that it redounds to Trump's favor, simply because it seems that everything is spinning out of control, that the Biden-Harris leadership has been so weak and ineffective, that it's that if you continue with this, then you know World War III is guaranteed, and so therefore Trump might bring order out of chaos. So that's why at the moment, but you never know, if a war emergency could redound in Harris's favor. But I tend to think that people just want the wars to stop. I mean, the American people's instinct is we don't want wars. We certainly don't want wars that we get dragged into and that we're going to get killed and destroyed. So Trump is more likely to bring these wars to an end than Harris is.
Yeah, but Dima, to be contrary, and George and I have talked about this before, you can make an argument either way, one way or another. I think the foreign policy elite, they're not against an escalation here, because as we've talked on this program before, these people see solving all problems all at the same time. And, it sounds like lunacy, but for a lot of these people, this is the opportunity of a generation. Go ahead, Dima.
Well, let's look what we have on offer from the United States. What do the candidates what can they offer us on the Iranian issue? Trump has just said something extremely stupid, like, I would not stop Israel, Netanyahu, from attacking nuclear, nuclear infrastructure of Iran. That's perfectly reasonable, a reasonable thing to do. That's awful, of course. But then we have Kamala Harris, who continues the same narrative, Khamenei is evil, Iran is evil, so we support Israel in its fight. Basically, these terrible assassinations which Israel is conducting, they are a logical conclusion from a very primitive picture of the world evil that has been created in the West in the last few decades. I mean, if you look at the image, what is the evil, Who is threatening the world? If you look at the media and politicians in the United States and in Europe, they say these are just crazy dictators. Usually it's an excuse for another aggression from the United States and from its European allies. Oh, that person ruling Iraq or Libya, he's just crazy. He's very dangerous. So Israel is following that playbook, saying, okay, we just kill these people, and then peace will return. But peace does not return because they killed these people.
It's the West that is out of control, not these alleged dictators. Gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns. I'm Peter Lavelle. Here we discuss some real news. George, I'm going to go back to you. It's really quite remarkable. Over the last week, we had 700 plus foreign policy dignitaries from the intelligence community, et cetera, endorse Kamala Harris, which is really interesting. If you look at the list, George, it's these 700 plus people that have created the mess that the world is in right now, okay? And Kamala Harris is very happy to accept their endorsement here. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, these 700 people, they're on the same list. They should all be indicted for war crimes, but not in the West, okay? These people are, what do they call them? The adults in the room? Your thoughts, George.
That's absolutely right. We have these 700 foreign policy, national security people, the people who have the expertise about world affairs. And then you also have Kamala Harris campaigning with Liz Cheney, the endorser of torture and the bombing of just about every country on the planet. She's also enjoyed the endorsement of Dick Cheney. And Harris has proudly touted this endorsement that now the Cheneys are with us. I think, I thought they were the bad people. I thought we weren't going to get into these stupid wars, wasn't it? How everybody was touting Barack Obama. Oh, no more stupid wars. Well, that's all long been forgotten. But it is very interesting that, what it is that these national security officials have against Trump. And, well, you know, Dima said earlier about Trump's, you know, extraordinary comment about Iran that, let's bomb nuclear facilities. Those are the things that you want to bomb. But so what is it that they object to? Well, yeah. Trump is the one person who actually does at times suggest that it might be a good idea to negotiate. And there he has in some way broken with the consensus, as he did in 2016. What was it that so offended the foreign policy elite in 2016? It's when he said, why can't we have good relations with Russia? That was very, very upsetting. That was never forgiven him for that. That it led to the whole Russia collusion hoax. So even now, he's the one person in the West, not one person in the West has suggested that the one way that we could bring this war to an end is by getting on the phone and talking to Moscow. And that's something, no, the official consensus of all of the governments in the West and of all these 700 national security officials is the way to end this war is to keep arming Ukraine, keep Ukraine going, keep sending more and more money, weapons, let Ukraine lob the missiles wherever they want. If they need to bomb Moscow, then they need to be able to bomb Moscow. And then, of course, Russia will magically come to the negotiating table and make all the due concessions. Trump is the only one who's saying, well, that may not be the way to go. And I think that's kind of why they're so infuriated with Trump.
Yeah, you know, Dima, for outsiders looking in, you know, I think a really good example was the single vice presidential debate. Where do they differ on? Guns, abortion, immigration, education, you know, the usual boilerplate issues in American politics. But the first question of the debate was about Iran. And both candidates, vice presidential candidates, came off more or less as foreign policy illiterate, and they did not even really address the question. The reason why I'm bringing this up is that you can talk about all you want about domestic politics, ideological reasons, for religious reasons, for whatever reasons, but just as George is saying, but not foreign policy. And that's why we have this huge convergence now. There is no debate about foreign policy. You really shouldn't even talk about it. Go ahead, Dima.
Well, there's no debate probably because it is so embarrassing. If we look at the situation, Netanyahu, George was right. He has been in Israeli politics for almost 30 years now, since 1996. People in the West who say that Putin has been in Russian politics far too long, they forget that Netanyahu has been at least 4 years longer than Putin in Israeli politics. And that's fine. You know, Israel is still called a democracy. But the problem is that Netanyahu and Zelensky, they kind of drag the United States and the European Union into very dangerous escalations. The United States and the EU would agree to a short, victorious war, you know, defeat Russia, you know, defeat Iran or Hezbollah, but just don't get us into the mess. Do it without any risks for us. And Netanyahu and Zelensky just go ahead and they do what they want. They put the West in danger and they're sure that they will get away with this. You know, how many negative articles have been published about Netanyahu since the late 90s? You know, he was vilified by the American press, but the message from him is, you're not going to do without me. I am your part, I am your blood, leave me. You will leave me in power. The same messages from Zelensky. You invested far too much into me. If you let me down now, the question will be, why did you give me all of these billions? So these people, it's a big question. A lot of people say, Netanyahu and Zelensky are just puppets of the West. It's a big issue. Who's puppet here?
I've been thinking this is kind of, people are talking about this, and I didn't expect that we would do this. But George, I mean, this client relationship, I mean, it seems to be a point of discussion right now. You know, you know, who leads the other. You know, the more I think about it, George, is that it's just, it's not necessarily national security interest, but it's this kind of a mindset of seeing the world where you, they don't see the differences. They assume that, that my interests are your interests, but in much more of a kind of a messianic way, and not necessarily a security one, which, you know, if it's messianic, it's really dangerous, okay, because it's devoid of reality. But I think that it's this is a artificial construct, you know, who's leading whom. I think it's much more a meeting of minds, George.
No, I agree with you, Peter, because when you think about Israel, let's say you have to think of, just think about the October the 7th attack, okay. It's accepted that Israel will retaliate, but it never occurs to anybody to think that a retaliation has to be proportionate. You don't wage a war of complete annihilation. Oh, well, that's our response. And that's what Israel does whenever Israel is attacked. It immediately launches a completely disproportionate attack against its neighbors. It wages this all or nothing war against its neighbors because, you know, anytime anyone dares to, you know, strike Israel, then of course, you know, Israel has the right to do whatever it wants at any time it wants, and no matter how destructive and how absolutely insane, because, you know, Israel's existence is at stake, which of course it isn't. And so, yeah, that is absolutely accepted. You know, throughout the West is that, yeah, well, Israel has a right to do whatever it wants for it, and when its security is at stake. And no one else gets to do that. Everyone else says, well, you have to make a proportionate response. You can't just simply wipe a state off the face of the earth just because you were threatened on one day a year ago. And in some ways, I think the same goes too for Ukraine. It's just, well, let's just keep this war going. And it never occurs to anyone to say, well, how long? How many lives is it worth sacrificing for this goal, which is just ridiculous? Ukraine's right to join NATO? So it's worth all these lives for this ludicrous goal of Ukraine's right to join NATO. And that's all that is, you know, saying, well, Ukraine's independence, Ukraine's sovereignty. That's all they mean. Ukraine's right to join a hostile military alliance. There is no such right. But that's the mentality of the Western foreign policy elites.
Wiping out an entire generation of young men. It's really extraordinary. You know, Dima, the kind of continue with this point here, I mean, particularly with Israel, but I think you can make somewhat the same argument when it comes to Ukraine, is that when you look at the personal emotional investment, I mean, when, you know, for many American politicians had been conditioned over for decades now that an attack on Israel is somehow an attack on the United States. And that's how they act. That's how they think. Okay. No, of course, the Israelis want, you know, they not only do they see themselves as the 51st state, they think of themselves as the first state of 51 states here. Again, it's just kind of a mentality, and this mentality obscures what real interests are, just like what George is saying. I mean, so you want to wipe out an entire generation of Ukrainian men to join a military alliance? Really? I mean, presumably, you know, if you'd stayed out of the alliance, you'd have a generation of young men. What's better? Keep going, Dima. Go ahead.
Well, the problem is with the Western ideology, because, defending your state, defending your territory is okay. That's natural. That's what nations have been doing since times immemorial. But the conflicts, for example, the conflict in Ukraine, it could easily be avoided. I mean, how did it start? The United States just and the European Union decided to use the opportunity. You know, Yanukovych, whom they considered pro-Russian for some reason, in reality he was pro-business.
For some reason.
Okay, but they considered him pro-Russian in their delusional world. So they basically forced him to postpone the signing of that association agreement with the EU. He didn't refuse to sign it. He asked to postpone it because he didn't have enough money to pay for it. So basically, he became unpopular with a certain part of Ukrainian population. So they used it to oust him. And then you had a domino effect in the worst possible sense. You know, the east of Ukraine seceded, basically, that could be expected. Also, there was talk of NATO expansion, and even Kissinger predicted that NATO expansion would lead to war. And it all developed so dramatically that ultimately it grew into an all-out war. And then the United States and the EU started puffing, saying, oh, the first major war since 1945. How could it be possible? The same thing with the Middle East. I mean, what do they mean when they say, we will do everything to protect Israel? Are you going to destroy countries? Are you going to start a nuclear war?
Gentlemen, we've run out of time here. But again, these are all wars of choice. And someone of power, of stature, has to say no. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Rostock rules.